Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm studying the myths and religions of the world and looking for inspiration that we can find in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our journey through the myths and legends of Hawaii. And if today's episode sounds a little odd, that is because I'm recording from the road, and I have my old microphone with me because it's more portable than my new microphone. So the sound quality may not be quite as good, but hopefully it should be not too bad, and we'll be back to normal for our next episode. In our last four episodes, we've covered the historical background of Hawaiian mythology, we've covered some of the sources for Hawaiian mythology, and we've covered two of the sort of four major gods, Kane and Ku. And in today's episode, we're going to take a look at the remaining two of the big four, Lono and Kanaloa. And then in future episodes, we're going to take a look at some more minor, although this is in big quotation marks, minor deities, as well as the great Polynesian hero, Maui. So let's start by looking at Lono and Kanaloa. So we have mentioned Lono previously, particularly because he was the deity who was celebrated during the Makahiki Festival, the New Year festival, if the New Year was 4 months long, or the New Year celebrations were 4 months long, the Makahiki season. We'll go into more detail about Makahiki later, but I don't know if it was celebrated continuously. What I've read suggests that there were some sort of states of it that were continuous, and then there were others that were specific events that just happened to fall within that period. Like all the other Hawaiian deities that we have looked at so far, Lono is a god of many things. A god of rain, a god of music. He's an agriculture god, a little bit like Ku. Sometimes he's a fertility god. I would say that it seems that Lono is a more peaceful deity than Ku, and perhaps maybe a little less highfalutin than Kane, although I don't know about that. In the stories in which he appears in Hawaii in mortal form, he is a chief, and there are a number of historical or kind of semi-historical legendary figures whose names are Lono something, like their names are connected to Lono, suggesting that he's associated with the Ali'i, the aristocracy, like many of the other deities. Like Kane and Kanaloa, and indeed like Ku, he is said to have lived in Hawaii as a mortal at one time, well, maybe in the appearance of a mortal, perhaps I should say, but to have left and to have promised to return. And some people believe that encounters with Europeans were initially seen as this is the return of Lono, because Lono is supposed to come back in this really big, spectacular vessel. And then when, you know, Captain Cook turns up, people interpret it that way. I mean, perhaps. I think that is a story that is often told. You know, we can see something similar in accounts of encounters between Cortez and, the Aztecs. Obviously, it's hard to know what people really thought, but I do think that there's maybe an element of trying to make people seem maybe more kind of superstitious than they really were. I don't know. That may have been a story that was used to contextualize these new arrivals. I don't really know. One of the most commonly told stories of Lono, which appears in Beckwith, in fact, I think appears in multiple versions in Beckwith, is a story in which Lono murders his wife. And this is kind of the origin of the Makahiki Festival. So Lono is living on Earth, and he has wedded a human woman. He sent out his brothers to go find him a bride. And another chief falls in love with Lono's wife and begins to sort of woo her. And Lono hears this wooing, but kind of jumps to conclusions. He kind of assumes that this means that his wife is having an affair. And so he flies into a rage and kills her, only to discover that he's made a terrible mistake. So he goes around doing various things, and he's sort of mad with grief and remorse. And eventually, having, like, run around the island and, you know, fought a bunch of people and done all these other things, he decides to leave. At least in some of the versions that I've seen, he says he's going to go to Kahiki, which is basically Tahiti. We have seen that a lot of what in other Polynesian languages would be T's are K's in Hawaiian. So an example would be kapu is the concept that we would more commonly think of as taboo, or as I'm about to mention, Kanaloa. In Maori, we would say Tangaroa. So there's some drift there, but, you know, he says he's going to go off to Tahiti, basically. Though we don't know that we are to understand this to mean, like, the real geographical Tahiti, but more sort of, you know, mythical ancestral homeland. But that one day he will return. And a lot of the ceremonies and celebrations of the Makahiki Festival are supposed to be kind of reenactments of the various things that Lano did while he was just kind of mad with grief. And it's always a very simplistic explanation to say that the purpose of myth is to explain ritual. But it would not surprise me to find that the purpose of this story was to, you know, come up with some reason for why these ancient traditions, they make sense actually. A lot of the celebrations of the Makahiki Festival involve athletic competitions, so things like boxing and wrestling. But Lano is also associated with the sport of surfing. And, we have, I think, not talked about surfing before, but, you know, this is Hawaii, this is where the sport comes from, really. And it is surprising to me, you know, it's just nice that you could kind of work a surfing competition into your game while remaining totally faithful to the legends that inspired it. The first person to write about surfing in English, I think, was I'm sure I've mentioned her before on this show, the 19th century English travel writer Isabella Bird, who spent 6 months in what was known as the Sandwich Islands at that time, I think to recover from a health, but like, she had some health problem, and it was thought that the good climate would help her, and she writes about surfing, and it is the longest I've ever read Isabella Bird go without saying something racist. That's just kind of what she was like, but I'll read you an extract, because I really do think it's quite a fun description. But this, I think, is from a letter to her sister. They were later printed. I think the book was called 6 Months in the Sandwich Islands, but I think you can also get it under the title The Hawaiian Archipelago. All right, here we go. I had written thus far when Mr. Severance came in to say that a grand display of the national sport of surf bathing was going on, and a large party of us went down to the beach for 2 hours to enjoy it. It is really a most exciting pastime, and in a rough sea requires immense nerve. The surf board is a tough plank shaped like a coffin lid, about 2 feet broad and from 6 to 9 feet long, well oiled and cared for. It is usually made of the erythrina, or breadfruit tree. The surf was very heavy and favorable, and legions of natives, were swimming and splashing in the sea, though not more than 40 had their papahenalu, or wave-sliding boards, with them. The men, dressed only in malos, carrying their boards under their arms, waded out from some rocks on which the sea was breaking, and, pushing their boards before them, swam out to the first line of breakers, and then diving down were seen no more till they reappeared, as a number of heads bobbing about like corks in smooth water half a mile from shore. What they seek is a very high roller, on the top of which they leap from behind, lying face downwards on their boards. As the wave speeds on and the bottom strikes the ground, the top breaks into a huge comber. The swimmers but appeared, posing themselves on its highest edge by dexterous movements of their hands and feet, keeping just at the top of the curl, but always apparently coming downhill with a slanting motion. So they rode in majestically, always just ahead of the breaker, carried shorewards by its mighty impulse at the rate of 40 miles an hour, yet seeming to have a volition of their own, as the more daring riders knelt and even stood on their surf boards, waving their arms and uttering exultant cries. They were always apparently on the verge of engulfment by the fierce breaker whose towering white crest was ever above and just behind them. But just as one expected to see them dashed to pieces, they either waded quietly ashore or, sliding off their boards, dived under the surf, taking advantage of the undertow, and were next seen far out at sea, preparing for fresh exploits. Two or three athletes, who stood erect on their boards as they swept exultingly shorewards, were received with ringing cheers by the crowd. Many of the less expert failed to throw themselves on the crest, and slid back into smooth water, or were caught in the combers which were fully 10 feet high, and after being rolled over and over, ignominiously disappeared, amidst roars of laughter and shouts from the shore. At first, I held my breath in terror, thinking the creatures were smothered or dashed to pieces, and then in a few seconds I saw the dark heads of the objects of my anxiety bobbing about behind the rollers, waiting for another chance. The description of what she looks like, by the way, she says, I've hired a horse and saddle, and with a McGregor flannel riding costume, which my kind friends have made for me, and a pair of jingling Mexican spurs, I'm quite Hawaiianized, which is an odd image. I'm sure that I'm imagining something quite different when I think of a McGregor flannel riding costume. But the Mexican spurs thing is interesting. Quite a lot of Mexican influence, especially in kind of post, when it was an American territory. Although this is during the kingdom period. Anyway, whatever. But there are other celebrations that could be fun. There's a mock battle that's part of it. There's a bit where the chief or king will come ashore and someone has to throw a spear at him, and one of his warriors has the responsibility of parrying the spear out of the air as it comes toward him. I mean, I'm sure they make it a pretty easy toss, you know, it's all ceremonial. But I do like it that knocking missiles out of the air is seen as, like, a skill that a warrior should possess. There are parts of this ceremony where these different statues of Lano, the long god and the short god, are taken, or the tall god and the short god, I did not write it down, are taken around during the Makahiki, and they receive offerings, and at different times in Hawaiian history, these offerings have been almost like plunder. Let me see. Yeah, this is the description of this rite as given by Beck. Lano Makua was the name given to the material form which represented the god at this time. It was a straight wooden post or mast, about 10 inches in circumference and 10 to 15 feet long, with joints carved at intervals, says Malo, and a figure at the upper end, which Alexander identifies as a bird. Near the top was tied a cross piece about 16 feet long, to which were hung feather wreaths, imitations of the skeleton of the Kaupu bird, and at each end long streamers of white tapa cloth, which hung down longer than the pole. Before the long god was brought out, fires were lighted on the beach, and the people bathed ceremonially in the sea and put on fresh garments. This bathing festival was called Hiuwai, water splashing. For 5 days thereafter, the high priest was kept blindfolded, and merrymaking, boastful demonstrations of prowess, and boxing were the occupations of the day. I like that idea that there's a certain period of time where the priest is blindfolded, so you can kind of do things that maybe you shouldn't be otherwise permitted to do. Offerings to the god were collected from each district. The long god was borne along the seacoast, the procession moving clockwise with the land side to the right. A little god was in the meantime borne along through the uplands in the opposite direction, followed by the people who gathered huge packs of edible fern as they went, and returned that same evening to the point of departure. It might take 20 days for the long god to make the circuit. At each chief's place, the carriers were fed. The chief's wife hung a fresh tapa cloth girdle about the god. There we see that again, the thing of dressing the images of deities for special occasions, like putting a tapa cloth, loincloth on Ku during the consecration, or Kuka'ili Moku during the consecration of his space in the PBD Essex Museum, or of dressing the stones of Kane. And the chief clasped an ivory tooth ornament upon it. "Hail to Lano," cried the people, while the priest prayed to the god and pointed out the clouds from Tahiti, which were the signs of his coming. Lano was often associated with clouds. Meanwhile, the keepers of each god hung bundles of roasted taro tops on the sides of their houses to break the tapu on labor. Fires were lighted on the night of Kane, and if they burned brightly and there was no rain, the bandage was removed from the eyes of the high priest, and the next day all could go fishing and eat the fish caught. When the long god returned, the ruling chief sailed out in a boat to meet the god, and on his return he was met by a company of spearmen. One of these threw a spear, which he or his attendant parried, and another touched him with a spear. A mock battle followed, and that night the ruling chief offered a pig in sacrifice of the heiau. And then it goes on, but later on it says, "During the passage of the long god from district to district, offerings for the god were collected in the form of vegetable food, live animals, dried fish, bark cloth garments, ornaments, and other valuable property. If the offering was considered too small, the god remained overnight until more could be gathered, and the land overseer was likely to be dispossessed. In Kamehameha's day, a kind of game was made of such an event. The pole was let down, and the whole following were at liberty to raid the district and take what property they pleased. But if anyone took anything after the pole was set straight again, he was subject to the owner's retaliation." Another aspect of the Makahiki festival is that various kapu come into force during the festival, and then certain rites have to be done to lift those kapu and return people to their normal occupations. You know, whether or not you follow the exact details of, like, which kind of food and what god has to sleep in which hut and so forth, I do think that the idea of, like, a ritual prohibition coming into effect and then some kind of task needing to be completed in order to lift that prohibition is something that could incorporate well into a game. Alright, so that's Lano. Now let's talk about Kanaloa. If you had to summarize Kanaloa in a one-er, you'd say he's the god of the sea. And that's true, but, you know, it could also be kind of an oversimplification. If you know anything about Maori myth and legend, as I said earlier, you might say that Kanaloa corresponds to Tangaroa, who's also a sea god. In Hawaiian myth, Kanaloa is often depicted as part of a pair with Kane. And indeed, I think Beckwith says that there's not that much information about Kanaloa distinct from Kane and Kanaloa. Some people think of him as an evil opposite to Kane, but there's obviously stories in which they are companions. So I don't know that evil opposite is a role that he plays consistently. And it's always tricky. I mean, I'm not trying to second guess anybody here, but we do have to remember that when we find something where a mythological character corresponds very strongly to, say, the devil, we have to think to ourselves, well, this is written by Christian. And that, you know, you can see that with Loki, I often think. Not that Loki's not an antagonist, but Christian writers had a tendency to look at an antagonist and go, oh, the devil. In some stories, though, and this is one where I've seen people argue that this is influenced by Christian thinking, Kanaloa is in league with these spirits who were the first spirits that were sent to Earth following the separation of heaven and Earth, and then they were rejected by the gods and sent to the underworld, where Kanaloa becomes the ruler of the underworld. This may be because of his kind of sea godness, that he has an association with the depths generally. There are other stories in which Kanaloa attempts to create life. He attempts to create humans like Kane did, but he fails, and you know, he carves a human out of stone and it remains stone. I do think that both spirits rejected by the gods and clumsy attempts by a bad god to create life are good categories of monster. I mentioned when we talked about Ku, and indeed about Kane, that there's lots of ways in which, in these stories, these deities are present in the landscape. And this is equally true for Kanaloa. So there are lots of places where, I mentioned that there are places where Kane is supposed to have lived, like fish ponds he's supposed to have dug, etc., etc. These are often done together with Kanaloa. So Kane and Kanaloa went to a place and they lived there, and they, you know, named this thing and they set up that thing. And, you know, there are a lot of landscape connections to Kane and Kanaloa. I mentioned that he's an underworld god. There may be a different underworld god called Milu, who is also just sometimes associated with Kanaloa. You know, he is Kanaloa, or he's like Kanaloa. Some of these stories say that Kanaloa was sent to the underworld because he wanted to drink Awa, or Ava. So Ava, if you're familiar with it, you may be more familiar with it under its Tongan name, that's Kava. Ava is a drink made from the roots of the Kava plant. It's a mild sedative that can also produce a feeling of euphoria, and it was widely drunk, particularly by the nobility in Hawaii, and then it was sort of suppressed, but today is making a little bit of a resurgence. If you go to Hawaii, you'll see places that serve Kava, or Ava. There are also places that serve it as part of, like, cocktails, you know, they include it with alcohol. I believe the jury is out on the potential health risks there, but prepared in the traditional way. You know, it is legal and it seems to be pretty safe. This is a pattern that we have seen before, this idea of a sacred drink. Ava, similarly, was denied to Kanaloa, so it's like he was trying to trespass on Kane's prerogatives. Kanaloa fills a slot that we have needed so far in this section, which is that he is an antagonist. One of, I think Beckwith says that he, like, wishes ill for humanity, but there are also cases where he is invoked favorably. So to put him in that role would be an oversimplification of his actual role in the mythology, but that is sometimes, you know, valid from an artistic standpoint, right? Like, as long as we're looking for inspiration for a fictional thing here rather than, you know, claiming to replicate Hawaiian mythology perfectly. I typically like to see antagonist deities have more complexity than just, like, they are bad. But it can sometimes be nice to have a straight-up villain. I do think that that is rather oversimplifying this complex and often contradictory figure of Kanaloa. He is sometimes depicted as a squid or octopus, which is a nice image. It reinforces his maritime theme. It's very legible, even to people who don't have a background in, you know, Hawaiian history and mythology. Like, we all know what a squid is or an octopus. I have seen modern interpretations that read Kanaloa as kind of symbolizing the unconscious mind. Now, I typically find it from a, like, history of religion or like a sociological or whatever perspective, anthropological perspective, I find these kinds of readings to be reductive. I don't think that they're very useful. But you can kind of see where they're coming from. This idea that Kanaloa is associated with things that we often also associate with the unconscious mind, particularly the ocean, right? The deep. And, you know, and also therefore with the underworld and with death. And that Kanaloa represents these kind of darker, less clear impulses in opposition to the representation of rationality and civilization, which would be Kane. Kane is the architect of the social order. Now, this kind of ignores the fact that Kanalo and Kane spend so much time together and are invoked as a partnership as much as they are invoked as antagonists. So if you wanted to think about the unconscious mind as the thing that Kanaloa symbolizes, then you would need to take that into account. So I find those kinds of interpretations a little bit too pat, but at the same time, for a game, I think they can be helpful in inspiring things that you want to do with your Kanaloa-like or Kanaloa analog. The idea of the unconscious, the idea that, as I think John Tynes wrote in the commonly underrated D20 Call of Cthulhu book, the sea is a secret. I think there's something there, the idea of diving down into things. And, you know, particularly I think Kanalo is important because if we're going to have a campaign that's rooted in the history and mythology and folklore and so on of Hawaii, one of the things that's really going to stand out about it is its maritime character. Compared to a game based on medieval England, you're going to spend a lot more time at sea. That's sort of one of the distinctive features of this landscape. So nice to have a sea god who is maybe hostile, maybe friendly, sometimes, at different times, and always a little difficult to understand, because I think that that's a nice distinction, right? You have it's almost like your town, wilderness, dungeon kind of distinction where PCs can set off from the rational, civilized world, the kind of Hawaii analog, and set out into the uncharted and unknowable ocean where the magical adventures begin, entering into the domain of Kanaloa. And I think that that's fun. I think that there's plenty of opportunity for kind of island hopping adventure, and the idea that the sea is this categorically different place that is Kanaloa's realm, I don't think is necessarily backed up by the mythology, but it's not backed up by the... Does that make sense? You can definitely find aspects of the myths of Kanaloa that fit that interpretation, even if, you know, I wouldn't put it in my term paper. All right, that is about all the Hawaiian myth and legend that we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to start looking at some of the other gods of Hawaiian mythology, including some who are quite prominent, and we're going to begin looking at Pele, the volcano goddess. So please join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.